From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, January 3rd, 2017. And on this day, Maine voters approved recreational marijuana on Election Day, and it'll soon be law, but what that looks like is still up in the air. And the world's oldest practicing Shaker has died, leaving just two members of the community behind. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
Maine adults age 21 and older will soon be able to possess and grow recreational marijuana. But Governor Paula Page and some in the legislature are calling for a moratorium that could delay implementation of the citizen-initiated law and further push back the retail sale, licensing, and testing of cannabis. All this means the future of the law is now in the hands of people with very divergent visions of what legalization should look like. Steve Missler has more.
By the end of the month, Mainers 21 and older will be able to possess up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana, grow up to 6 mature plants, and cultivate an unlimited number of seedlings. They won't be able to buy or sell marijuana. Not yet. That's because the law gives the state 9 months to create the regulatory structure to license, sell, test, and tax it. Supporters of Question 1 believe that the timeline is adequate and that policymakers should not delay the process. They also agree that lawmakers should move quickly to make it clear that minors cannot possess cannabis, a loophole flagged by Attorney General Janet Mills last fall. But the governor and some lawmakers say the state also needs more time, more money, and potentially more laws before legal pot is ready for prime time. LePage told Bangor radio station WVOM today that lawmakers should pass a moratorium.
I think it would be appropriate. I don't think that they realize what they've done.
LePage says he needs $5 million to create the regulatory structure, and he says lawmakers should create rules to deal with impaired drivers. Republican Senate President Michael Thibodeau agrees. He supports a one-year moratorium. Addressing the topic on the Maine Public Call-In show, Maine Calling, today, Thibodeau said there are other issues drafters of the legislation may not have considered. For example, people in the hospitality industry have asked him about marijuana use in hotel rooms that allow smoking.
You rent a room and you happen to be a smoker, well, does that mean you should walk into a room that smells like Cheech and Chong, hung out there over the weekend? I mean, I think not. I don't think that that's good for tourism in our state.
Democratic House Speaker Sarah Gideon agrees that the new law creates a slew of what she described as ancillary issues. But she says lawmakers should address those problems as they arise. Gideon says she doesn't support an immediate moratorium because the law gives the state 9 months to create the regulatory apparatus.
Until the regulation and licensing is set up, that is an automatic moratorium on the sale, in fact, and that gives us the space to do what we need to do.
Changes, fixes, and overhauls of marijuana laws are not uncommon in the handful of states that have legalized marijuana prior to the November election. In Colorado, for instance, lawmakers passed over 80 bills after the state began overseeing the recreational sale and taxing of pot 2 years ago. But here, proponents of legal marijuana are concerned that trying to anticipate and address all the issues with legal pot now will only delay and possibly deny the will of voters. David Boyer, who helped lead the pro-legalization campaign, acknowledged that calls for a moratorium were probably emboldened by the recent and surprising move by Massachusetts legislators to push back retail marijuana until July of 2018. But Boyer says a delay here would be a mistake, potentially creating a prolonged period between legal possession and cultivation without a system to oversee the legal sale, testing, and taxing.
Let's give our best effort to making this deadline. And in 7-8 months, if we don't make it and the state needs more time, then let's cross that bridge when we get to it.
It took Colorado just over a year to develop its regulatory apparatus after voters there approved legal pot. That could be the timetable for Maine, too. Already, there's discussion that the agency currently tasked with overseeing the retail sale and testing of pot, the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, may not be the best fit to do so. And resolving some issues, such as impaired driving, could take a while. Last year, lawmakers attempted to craft a law that set a limit on the amount of the psychoactive component in marijuana, THC, that's in a driver's bloodstream to determine impairment. The proposal failed. As it turns out, different people have different tolerance levels to marijuana, and at the State House, lawmakers have different views of legal marijuana. Those differences will soon be debated. Attorney General Janet Mills has already proposed a cannabis commission to oversee legal issues with the end of pot prohibition. Meanwhile, House Speaker Sarah Gideon and Senate President Michael Thibodeau are contemplating a stakeholder group to oversee implementation. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Maine's House Speaker and Senate President also used today's Maine Calling to weigh in on some other front burner issues before the incoming legislature, including implementation of Question 2 on the fall ballot. That new law creates a fund for public schools through a 3% surtax on household incomes over $200,000. Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon told Jennifer Rooks the vote reflects frustration over Augusta's repeated failures to adequately fund local schools, but Senate President Michael Thibodeau said he disagrees.
It isn't necessarily about adequately funding education. It's about where we get that funding. I think people are tired of their property taxes going up. Property taxes are a real burden, particularly on our elderly people who want to stay in their home, age in place, yet they're faced with this enormous burden of property taxes. So I think that referendum was really about their property taxes and where we are going to get the resources to fund our schools, because we have great public institutions. Our children are very fortunate to have the schools to go to that they have, but how we fund that is important. I think that the voters were clear. They are tired of their property tax bill going up.
So another topic, House Republican Assistant Minority Leader Ellie Espling is calling for a new committee to specifically deal with the state's opioid crisis. New committees are not concocted regularly. Do you all each support the idea of creating a committee to deal with this crisis?
I support the idea of it might be a joint select committee, as Representative Espling put forward. It might be more of a task force that actually includes people from the healthcare world, from the law enforcement world, from the world of people who are out there helping those who are addicted right now.
The question quickly becomes, is this joint select committee better prepared to deal with the opioid crisis than the standing committees of jurisdiction already? Regardless of whether we have a select committee or not, this is going to be one of the big topics of the 128th legislature.
Governor LePage will release his budget later this week. He has publicly expressed a desire to shrink government and institute, quote, major cuts. Mike Thibodeau, do you share the governor's goals to broadly reduce state government?
Sure. Well, I mean, look, if we can find a way to more efficiently deliver state government, we should be looking to do that every time. And, you know, over the past 6 years, I think that the governor has tried to do that. It looks like he's going to continue that trend of looking for more efficient ways to deliver the services. And, you know, at the end of the day, the budget that he proposes will be well vetted. There'll be plenty of opportunity for people that are affected both in positive and negative ways to weigh in on that. But, you know, we look forward to Friday getting here and getting a look at what he's proposing.
We want government that works for people. It's not simply about shrinking government. It is about thinking about people's lives and how what we do here affects them every day, whether they're sitting around their kitchen table looking at their checkbooks, whether they're thinking about what kind of education their kids are getting in school. That is and will remain my top priority here.
The oldest practicing Shaker in the world has died at her home in New Gloucester at the age of 89. The passing of Sister Frances Carr leaves just two members in the small religious community that gives up personal possessions, lives communally, and devotes itself to prayer. The Shakers first came to America from England in the 18th century and were at one point active in a dozen communities in New England. As Susan Sharon reports, the goal of the last few survivors remains the same, to see that Shakerism endures.
Sister Frances Carr was just 10 years old in 1937 when her father died, and hard economic times forced her mother to turn over Frances and her younger sister to the Shaker's Sabbath Day Lake community. Their five older siblings were already living there, and Brother Arnold Hadd says that experience shaped the character of the woman who became what he calls the best ambassador the community ever had.
She was always seeking out the needy and the lowly and trying to make them a part, to give them something that they didn't necessarily have.
The Shakers were known for taking in orphans. Those who embraced the basic tenets of the Protestant sect were welcome to join when they became adults. Here's how Sister Frances described those tenets, known as the three C's.
It's a sharing of all things in common, so it's a religious communism, a living in community. We're also a celibate community, and we also believe in the confession of sin.
But Sister Frances also recognized that Shakerism was not the best fit for everyone, and not just because of celibacy. In her autobiography, Growing Up Shaker, she writes about the departure of her sister and other friends from the community. For most people, she said, putting God ahead of self and giving up independence was simply too much. Not for her. She said that once she became a Shaker, she never felt alone.
I am very happy. No life is absolutely completely free of worry or troubles, but it's the life I've chosen, and it's where I intend to spend the rest of my life.
As a Shaker, along with her love of faith, Sister Frances discovered a love of cooking. She became the head cook at the age of 21, and then a trustee who helped handle the community's financial affairs, and eventually a spiritual leader.
She was always the family spokesman. Many people in this life are kind of shy and retiring. Frances Carr was never shy and never retiring, and she was always right there. And she had a very easy manner about her that no matter who you were, she could approach you and you would feel special.
Sister Frances died Monday of complications from melanoma, and Brother Arnold says in typical Shaker tradition, she did not die alone. She was surrounded by friends and family who prayed with her and sang Shaker songs to send her off. In an interview in 1998, Sister Frances said she prayed every day for new members to join their ranks, and Brother Arnold says he and the other remaining member will continue those same prayers. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And that's This Day in Maine, Tuesday, January 3rd, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin, Keith Shortall, and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.